Thank you, and thank you for being promptly back. I'm sorry for many of you who've been here since the morning. I apologize personally. I'm told that everybody knows I've been doing exam marking, thanks to Nilanjan, so you know exactly why I wasn't here, and I'm grateful for that. But may I, with the permission of my panelists, just take a moment to say how important this day is. I think in LSE's calendar, for the South Asia Center, definitely, that we have had, for a few years now, some of the finest research on Bangladesh has been published by academics based here at LSE, three very senior people who are present and part of this summit itself, and a whole host of PhD students, postdoc researchers, and now young colleagues that we have welcomed to LSE. So I think LSE is really one of the most important places in the world, probably, for a concentration of really terrific world-leading social science research on Bangladesh. And this has been a goal of the South Asia Center since we set it up 3 years ago yesterday, to make this a genuinely South Asia Center, not an India Plus Center, like many of our colleagues pretend to be as South Asia Centers. So this is our first really big Bangladesh event, and for that I must thank two people. One is Professor David Lewis, who's at the table, who's been an absolutely terrific supporter of the center as an academic, as the head of department in social policy, but and as a friend of the center even before it was set up. And I think, David, even before we set up the South Asia Center, Sanchita, our colleague who I want to talk about in a minute, at Berkeley was here, and your new book was published, and we organized a book discussion which had a terrific turnout and a discussion, really lively, in one of the rooms in this building, which we did even before the center was formed. And we could see what kind of things we could do at very quickly, nimble-footed, quick response time, put together things. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank my colleague, the Deputy Director of the South Asia Center, Dr. Nilanjan Sarkar, everything that's happening today, all the people who are here, if they're well fed and watered and looked after and are here on time, it's entirely his credit. He dreamt up the whole Bangladesh summit along with our colleagues in Berkeley, and our warm thanks, my warm thanks as well to Nilanjan. I'm really here as a guest moderator for this panel and amidst marking exams. But I think it's also very important to mark this collaboration with Berkeley. It is terrific. I think it's, is it the only dedicated Bangladesh center anywhere in the world, the Subir and Malini Chaudhary Center? And as you've no doubt heard, this is a series of collaborations over the next few years that we intend to carry forward. This is just the beginning of a long journey. And I hope many of you who are here today will remain connected, write for our blog, our much-read blog, which, again, we are very keen. Both our editors, Mahima and Becky, are here, do a very good job of trying to keep South Asia focus going. And my thanks also to Shema, our administrator, who really has, if you've had lunch, our speakers at least, and for those of you there's leftovers there, all the logistics have been done by Shema. So I think, I'm sorry for taking that extra time just here, but I thought it was important to thank everybody while they were still in the room. Now, this panel on civil society really was, for a long time, those people who didn't know very much about Bangladesh and possibly did not even know very much about the Bangladesh state knew about Bangladesh's civil society. Bangladesh, its social movements, its human rights work, a number of non-state actors or in various fields, some of which we have heard about, is something that most people working in international development or working in human rights law or working in anthropology would have heard about Bangladesh and known something about. And I think so we could not have a first Bangladesh summit without dedicating one panel, at least, on the discussion to civil society per se. And to do this with us, I have really three excellent people. Let me start with my right. We have Joe Devine, who is based at Bath. That's where he hides, which is why none of us have met him before, but delighted to welcome you. He's a lecturer in the International Development Department. And he's country coordinator for Bangladesh in an ESRC research group called Well-being in Developing Countries, and has been working on themes of well-being, poverty, and inequality. And then Sara Hussein, who I've known about for many years, but we very happily met for the first time in Goa earlier this year at another very exciting summit. And Sara, of course, as many of you know, is a Supreme Court lawyer in Bangladesh. And there are many things to say about Sara's CV, but I just wanted to mention that in 2016, she was awarded the International Women of Courage Award by the U.S. Secretary of State. You can tell us what that was like. Not by Trump, she hastens to add. That's what she's saying to her co-panelists. Fine, then you can stay.
It's okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, but actually, getting a Woman of Courage award from Trump has its own moment, I think. But also, perhaps, especially where legal activism becomes so important, such a critical part of civil society work, is her role in drafting that first piece of legislation that became law in 2010 against violence against women, on violence against women. And finally, Professor David Lewis, who is head of Department of Social Policy, or have you now stepped down, and that's why he's here and looking happier, who, of course, we also discussed your new book, didn't we, David, some time ago, well, a couple of years ago, which, again, I remember how radically it altered the way even other South Asianists thought about Bangladesh, which I thought was even more important than a wider international audience. Suddenly people sat up and took notice and said, hang on a second, Bangladesh is doing rather well. And why is it doing so well? And that is something that we need to understand. So I'm not going to take up any more time. The panelists will speak for about 7 to 8 minutes each. I may ask you to come back on a couple of things, but we'll open it up to Q&A as quickly as we can, since it's so lively. So over to you.
So I must warn you from the beginning that the 7 to 8 minutes was David's pre-lunch. You had everyone saying, let's do it in 8 minutes rather than 15 or 10 or whatever. Anyway, here we go. I want to start with three observations, and I think they're useful in terms of trying to think about civil society broadly. Okay? The first is a quote that's been attributed to one of the ministers in 2015 in Bangladesh, and I have to read it because it's a quote. Civil society members only offer advice. They are like a cancer on society. This parasite, the cancer named civil society, must be uprooted from society. So I don't think I need to give much analysis of where that one is going. But it's one view of civil society which is currently floating around. The second is something that I collected last year when I was trying to do some work about how at a local level politics, formal politics and community-based organisations come together. And I came across what I thought was a rather quirky membership group who insisted that they weren't an NGO, which is quite right. They kept on saying they were Nagarik Andalon, a citizens' movement. And what they, when I kept pushing, well, what does that mean? The only thing they would say is, we're definitely not civil society. And I still to this day scratch my head and think, well, what does that Nagarik Andalon actually mean? The third thing I want to raise is something that came up in the newspapers last weekend. So the Prime Minister wants us to have a new social movement against drugs to replicate the success of the social movement against terrorism. And this is interesting that the Prime Minister is calling for something which we would identify normally as a civil society type thing. It contrasts with her January statement in Parliament when she likened civil society to a dustbin and a donkey. And I'm not quite sure how I'm ever going to be able to explain those two. Right, so in 7 minutes I want to say, I think, five things. They're general. They're going to be generalisations. That's the nature of 7 minutes and 5 points to make. The first is, and it goes back to something that was said this morning, if we're thinking about civil society, we need to think about the historical evolution of these institutions in Bangladesh. And that's important because it means that we always have to keep an eye on the relationship between the type of political order that we have and the type of citizenship type activities that it allows or enables or restricts. And that changes over time. Okay? Now, if we look at Bangladesh, we've got a turbulent, rather short, turbulent political history, but as has already been mentioned, A lot of people knew about Bangladesh's civil society before they knew about the state, the government, the political history. And that's because, well, mostly through NGOs, but not only NGOs. In that turbulent history, in that relationship between political order and the possibility of citizenship action, there are two big things I think have happened in Bangladesh. One has been the NGOisation of civil society, and David will perhaps speak more about that. But the second has been the party politicisation of civil society. So if you take any major civil society grouping in Bangladesh, and it doesn't matter if it's lawyers, if it's media, if it's doctors, if it's teachers, if it's students, they'll be run down party lines. You'll have your BNP faction, you'll have your Awami League faction. And it's pervaded all types of civil society activity. Some have argued that in the past it's pervaded NGO activity, with particular groups following particular political parties or whatever. Now, what's the problem with that? Well, in principle, no problem, okay, but configured in that way, with the kind of power of political parties over civil society, this idea that we might have in our head of a civil society that spearheads public life, challenging the state or keeping the state to account, starts to feel weak. Because civil society is so embedded in the same structures and the same processes that it wants to challenge. Now, when we've got civil society organisations that have... What the other implication of this is that it's very difficult for any civil society organisation in Bangladesh to remain politically neutral. Even if you're silent, you're seen as being for or against a particular party. What does that then mean? Well, it means that at some point, if you're trying to keep that neutral position, and we could question whether or not that's a good thing, what will political parties do? They'll just create their own front organisations to overtake the space, to crowd you out. And the most obvious example here is student movements. So student movements were taken over by political parties in order to enhance a particular form of civil society organisation. So that's the first point. The relationship between the type of political order and the type of citizenship activity that one can have, it does change over time. The second idea I wanted to raise kind of plays around with the distinction between institutions and organisation, and the need to understand that relationship. Institutions shape society, and institutions shape the behaviour of actors within society. They set the rules of the game. Organisations populate and operate within that landscape. They follow the rules. Okay, and the importance of that is we need to understand then what is the institutional context in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is an agrarian society in the past. It's changed. But a lot of the elements of that past make themselves present in different forms today. So I put forward that what the institutional context does look like in Bangladesh is characterised by partisanship, patronage, deference, hierarchy, a winner-takes-all mentality, behaviour that it's built as much on informal practice as formal ones, behaviour that looks after private interests as well as public ones. The key point, however, is because that's the institutional landscape, all organisations are embedded equally in that landscape. And that doesn't matter if you're government, it doesn't matter if you're business, and it certainly doesn't matter if you're civil society. So successful civil societies in Bangladesh are organisations that have managed to negotiate the rules of the game. And they know that they have to manage the negotiation of those rules of the game. That makes it complicated, because they are so embedded in the same institutional imperatives and logics than government and business and in any other form of organisation. So it becomes difficult then for civil society to challenge and confront problems of governance, human rights, exclusion, when they themselves are so embedded in the same matrix, the people that they might be trying to attack or hold to account. The third point, the current political setup in Bangladesh, where are we? The ruling party came in and it sees itself as a movement of liberation. Over the past 5 years, what we've seen is a clear move towards a political settlement, in my view, that's based on the dominance of a single party, and that's moved away from the dominance of two parties that were changing power between them. This has led to the erosion of any meaningful political opposition, managed significantly by the state's reliance on the police and security forces. Why can the ruling party get away with this? Why has this power become so strong? Because it's been successful in promoting economic growth and bringing a whole range of benefits to its citizens. Bangladesh is a very good neoliberal citizen. It's doing very well. The question then becomes, in exchange for those gains, what's the tolerance level of citizens? At what point do they become less tolerant of, let's say, the rather negative aspects of having too much power? So, the current situation puts civil society in a very difficult position because of the power held within the ruling party. What have we seen that gives us that? We've seen recently quite a lot of pressure on the media. We've seen pressure more recently on the judiciary, and Sarah may be able to say more about that. Recent regulations give government far more power to monitor NGO funding and their programmes. Locally, NGOs need a yearly clearance certificate in order to operate. All NGOs are frightened stiff in case they get blacklisted. Social media sites have been shut down, and we've heard this morning bloggers have been killed. There are spies everywhere in Bangladesh, and the risk of normal civil society mobilisation, the risks are high. So, at one level, civil society is slightly in retreat mode, and being uncontroversial is popular. My fourth point looks at intermediation. So an important role of civil society is the function that it does intermediating between citizen and the state. And there are two kind of aspects to that, it seems to me. One is the impact that it might have on the quality of politics, a governance type question. And the other is the impact it might have on empowering citizens. Okay. The first one, that's a bit intransient. In other words, it's something that we always have to continually do. We always have to try and keep the government to account in any country. It's never quite finished. The empowerment of citizens is more durable. If you're successful, you can build on that and take that empowerment further. And Bangladesh has had a history of civil society organisations and NGOs building that citizens' capacity. I don't have the numbers to back me up on this one, but my sense is that the number of civil society organisations focusing on building citizen power or developing citizen subjectivity has declined. My sense equally is that things like rights-based organisations, whether they be NGOs or not, they are now a much smaller part of the wider civil society landscape in Bangladesh. It's not surprising that many NGOs have turned to advocacy organisations. In advocacy, you get a certain amount of security, protection. But in advocacy, of course, you can easily be picked off. Does this matter? I'm not sure that it does. But if we take certain initiatives that have taken place pushed by civil society, we can start to see where the lack of citizenship or the lack of citizens' power becomes important. So in 2009, the Right to Information Act came about. It was meant to be a great triumph of civil society. It was meant to curb corruption in all levels of the state. And what's happened since then? Well, not a lot. Since 2010 to 2017, I think the Right to Information Commissioner has seen about 1,000 cases. A man or a woman who's unoccupied. So while there might be stories of successes with things like the right to information, it hasn't really taken hold in the way that it might have done in India. It has done in India. Mm. Why is that the case? Well, one of the reasons is in India, citizens have taken hold much more of the Right to Information Act than they have in Bangladesh. So therefore, it does matter if that citizen's power isn't enhanced and if it starts to get weaker. This brings me to my final point, and I'm not quite sure how to put it, but when I think about civil society right now in Bangladesh, the main concern I have, I think there's a real lack of infrastructure to support challenging politics. Civil society in Bangladesh has been robust precisely because it's been vibrant, because it's been able to innovate, because it's been able to look forward and respond positively, and because it's been committed to democracy. Today, my feeling is that some of that vibrancy has been lost, and perhaps civil society organisations are not as innovative as they used to be. In other words, some of that energy has been sapped. I still think civil society can make serious contributions to progressive political outcomes. However, it depends on its ability to recover some of that vibrancy and innovation. And I can't help but feel it's a missed opportunity. You know, there's two big ingredients in Bangladesh that would make civil society and citizen action important and powerful. One, there are people. And two, there's much more money around now, including philanthropic funds. Civil society organisations should be able to tap into those. But I don't think Bangladesh civil society organisations are organised to be able to tap into those successfully. So that sense of a lack of infrastructure. So I leave with a hanging question. Perhaps we do have to start thinking, and this involves us who are observers or researchers, thinking beyond civil society to a certain extent. And we've had examples this morning. Tanvir's presentation talked about different forms of movements. We've known about Shahbag and things like that that have happened in Bangladesh. Naomi Hossein has challenged us with research on unruly politics, which in a way is drawing us back from civil society into an idea about political society. So perhaps, for me anyway, in order to build that infrastructure, that vibrancy again, I think it's incumbent on all of us to start thinking more creatively about the possibilities of civil society and to perhaps take off some of the straitjackets that have kept us where we have been for many years. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to try and pick up and continue the story around what is obviously a very big topic, state and civil society. I'm going to move on and talk a little bit more about the NGO part of civil society. And as I think came out of quite a lot of the discussion this morning, we are increasingly talking about Bangladesh in the context of very dominant myths and stories and inevitably offering oversimplification. So when it comes to NGOs, if one looks, again, taking this theme of history that we've been picking up this morning, I mean, there are two sort of dominant stories. I mean, one of them is the sort of, you know, the very positive one of NGOs as a sort of vanguard of civil society and as the most visible and active non-state actors out there. And that was, I think, quite a dominant view. For some people, maybe it still is, I'm not sure. But then there's also the sort of much more critical view of NGOs as the sort of institutionalized neoliberal actors who are kind of, you know, taking forward this Bangladesh success story, but have weakened social movements and are the sort of apolitical endpoint of social movements. So I'm going to try and say, well, look, it is a lot more complicated than that. But there's no doubt that a lot of people for a long time talked about Bangladesh as having a vibrant, innovative and diverse NGO sector. In the 90s, there was the world's attention on organizations like BRAC and the Grameen Bank that were engaged in, you know, delivery of credit, social mobilization of organizing particularly rural people and mobilizing them against structural injustice. And I think, you know, there was a case that there was this, you know, vibrancy. If we look at the sector today, certainly there's much more of a monoculture. There's NGOs are predominantly engaged in service delivery, credit. You know, they're quite large and diverse, what I've called in some of my writing, the radical NGO subsector, organizations that would have included Prashika, Shamota, GSS, a whole bunch of organizations involved in mobilization are no longer there. Since the early 2000s, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, they've either declined or they've disappeared. And the reasons for that, I think, are many. They are to do with leadership and management systems, organizational factors. They're also to do with the policy of international donors, because these were indigenous NGOs. That's been one of the maybe unique aspects of Bangladesh and the discourse around NGOs. However, they have been funded, you know, predominantly by international donors. So their changing policies and their intrusiveness and conditionalities have been a factor there. But also the nature of vertical arrangements and relationships in Bangladeshi society around patron-client relations, if one looks at the sorts of mobilization strategies and the problems that they ran up against in terms of structural inequalities and patronage, I think it was very clearly shown that building the kinds of solidarities that were horizontal was far more difficult and problematic than maybe expected. So I think, one can argue about the changes within the NGO sector, but recent empirical work that I've undertaken with Abul Hussein in Faridpur and Dhaka has sort of, I think it confirms those sorts of assumptions in general terms. And so we first did field work just over 10 years ago, and at that time we found, a diverse group of NGOs that were doing both service delivery and also very interesting mobilization work, and particularly in conjunction with local government institutions, so union parishads, changing village institutions, around disputes settlement, and all kinds of interesting coalitions around NGO groups and local government and local elites too. Going back there 10 years later, there's much less of that mobilization work going on. Many of the rights-based NGOs that I'd mentioned that were active are no longer there. The only organization standing really from that radical NGO group today is Nigera Kori, which in a sense, as an organization, as a sort of counterexample, shows that none of this is inevitable. The decline of this part of NGO work obviously needs to be explained. It's much smaller than it was. So I think if that's right, then, and if we can generalize, from that work, then there are worrying implications. The synergies which we believe can arise from the civil society local government relationship, which we'd observed earlier but are now much less evident, the implications for civil society's role as a watchdog, the idea that it helps with accountability and it holds the state accountable, and also, and I think this is important, for the democratic value of civil society as a space for creating political competition, and also for nurturing new local political leaders for political leadership. And those are things which, studies of civil society and NGOs in other places have demonstrated as being important. So, for example, some of my colleagues working in Latin America have shown how, civil society and local political leadership are intertwined in ways that have contributed to democratization. So in the 90s, we would have had NGOs like GSS that would have been helping to put up landless people, men and women, as candidates in local elections for local bodies. We weren't seeing any of that going on in Faridpur in the areas that we were studying now. So instead, what we have is a range of NGO activities that are effectively underpinning the kinds of economic changes that we've been talking about around economic growth. We have, financial services, we have support to small businesses, we have loans, even loans for migration. This was a new thing in the last 10 years, people borrowing in order, to migrate. So there's an expansion of NGO activities in the financial and market field, but a shrinking of NGO activities in the rights and mobilization field. So I suppose, and this is my final point, I suppose the question is, does this matter? Does it matter that NGOs are no longer doing the diverse range of activities that they once were. But also, does it matter, and this came up earlier as well, actually, is that people don't really want to be an NGO anymore. NGO is kind of a degraded term. Interestingly, civil society may also, be degraded. But I think trying to understand, what does it mean when people say, we don't want to be an NGO, or, we're not an NGO? What does that mean? Does it mean that we are kind of independent of international linkages or funding? Or does it mean that we are flexible and we don't have a certain kind of organizational structure? Does it mean that we are not connected to this new party politicization around civil society? There's lots of different things, and I think if we were to focus on that, I think that would be an interesting thing to learn. But I think it also tells us something about civil society as both a system and an idea, if we borrow the ideas from Abrahams about the state as both a system and an idea, that clearly civil society as a system is under enormous strain at the moment in Bangladesh. There's the legislation which is restricting it, the NGO Act of 2016. There's the reduction or even elimination of political opposition. And there's the change away from a diverse range of activities to a much narrower range of activities. But clearly the idea of civil society hasn't gone away, that we can look in different ways at this. We can investigate it, I think, in different ways. I mean, one of them is the distinction that's been made between political society and civil society by Partha Chatterjee, and the idea that actually it's political society with all its messiness and its inequalities and its patron-client vertical relationships, which is where poor people are struggling for rights and struggling to advance their interests. But I think it also leads us to look at ideas about understanding much better patron-client relationships and their content, and not just their instrumental or oppressive content, but also their moral content and the way in which, as a strategy for advancing interests and for providing security and for expressing ideas about change and about the future, that there may be more of these things going on in this limited or constrained civil society space than maybe we're able to see. And if one looks, for example, at the forms of citizen helping that emerged in the context of the Rohingya crisis last year, lots more kind of spontaneity. So it may be that we can talk a little bit about reconfiguration rather than shrinking civil society space, that new emerging forms of small issue-based groups, forms of citizen helping, less dependent on donor funding, or maybe less prone to political capture or to leadership failure or leadership problems, all of which had undermined areas of radical civil society in the past. So to end, I think civil society remains an important framework, I think, for talking about a whole range of things, from citizenship to state, to activism and resistance. It's a changing frame for talking about that, but arguably, I think NGOs, as we may have previously understood them, are a less important part of that frame. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David. So I want to just carry on exactly as David carried on from Joe, by carrying on from him, to focus on rights-based organizations and campaigns around rights and why we don't have very many of them and what we have and to what extent they're successful and where they can't be. And I've thought that in the context of our panel of civil society in the state, I should speak about sentiments, silences, spaces, and still remaining solidarities and the change that they can make. I'm going to talk a bit about NGO type of groups as well as non-NGO groups and the reduced number of NGOs operating in a rights framework, as well as other organizations, other civil society spaces, as in students' organizations, journalists, especially now not only the print media and electronic media, but bloggers as well, and of course about lawyers. And really what I'm going to focus on is what is the context that we need in terms of being an active civil society, or rather, I would also prefer to say active, I think, citizens' organizations, Nagarik Andalon or Nagarik Shangathan, working on issues of rights. And again, everyone has mentioned that already, that you need some kind of institutional framework where you have safety and security. To what extent do we have that, and where are the threats coming to that? And where do we also see, in addition to threats, inducements coming, which silence you, which prevent the acts of solidarity? Being a lawyer, I'm sorry, as a Bangladeshi lawyer, of course, generally I would start with the Magna Carta, but I'm going to spare you that and start with the Constitution of 72, which is only 46, 47 years ago. But I think it is important, particularly in the context of our morning's conversations, to kind of look at some of the paradoxes, if you like, or some of the constraints that are kind of already embedded in this document that we always cite as, you know, our foundational document and the source of rights. So if you look at this poster from 71, from the Liberation War, and it says the Hindus of Bengal, the Christians of Bengal, the Buddhists of Bengal, the Muslims of Bengal, it seems very obvious to us in 2018. It doesn't say anything about the non-religious of Bengal. It's very striking now. It clearly wasn't a concern in 72. But it also says then at the bottom, we are all Bengalis. And I think we talked a lot in the morning about how these exclusions, these sort of foundational exclusions, have been very much the areas around which we've seen movements and organizing in the years since, whether it's around ethnicity or around religious. There's no recognition, as you can see, of ethnic difference there. So just looking very quickly at the changes that have happened and I'll go on to talk about how those affect our work now as citizens' organizations working around issues of rights and justice. You can see some really substantive shifts. So in terms of secularism, you'll all be familiar with this, that the shift from the 72 sort of full-on secularism, if you like, the ban on religion-based politics and the understanding that there would be a complete separation of religion and state, to what we have now, this peculiar hybrid situation that none of us really understand, where we have both secularism and Islam as a state religion, and a very kind and generous concession that other religions may have equal status and equal rights in practice. In terms of equality, we have a prohibition on discrimination on certain grounds, race, religion, sex, caste, and place of birth. We also have affirmative action provisions. And in the context of 2018, again, all of you who are following recent Bangladesh developments, you'll know that we have this extraordinary development in terms of the challenge to quotas for Muktijoddhas, for freedom fighters, which has been followed by an even more extraordinary response of saying all quotas, all reservations, not only for freedom fighters and their children and grandchildren, but quotas for women, quotas for the for people with disabilities, quotas for indigenous people are by executive fiat being directed to go. In terms of freedom of expression, which I think is a critical space, critical issue in terms of what we're talking about now in terms of the movement of citizens' organizations, our original constitution is not terribly helpful in terms of not giving us very broad rights on freedom of expression in any case and limiting it by existing laws, and those have only been added to in the years since. So just to look at some of the restrictions that we have in terms of speech, there are two axes around which these restrictions run. One is around what you'll be familiar with from a lot of the international media around Bangladesh, the restrictions on speech about religion. And just looking quickly at this, I'm not going to force you into a class on law. Please don't worry about that. But just if you just look at the colors, that should give you the understanding that we really need. The blue bits are the British Empire and what they left us. The green bits are what we have given to ourselves, post-independence legislation. 1974 Special Powers Act, 2006 BNP-era Information, Communication and Technology Act, criminalizing online speech of various kinds, but particularly online hurt to religious sentiment, penalizing it with a maximum of 14 years of rigorous imprisonment and a minimum of 7. And then, of course, the extraordinary 2011 amendment to the Constitution, which says that criticism of the Constitution itself will be considered to be a seditious act. And now this year, the Digital Security Act, which again talks about online religious sentiment. If you look at the restrictions on speech about the state, again, the blue bits are what we have been left by the empire, and the green bits are us. And if you look at these, just to pick out a couple of them, particularly the 2006 ICT Act, you will look at online, you will see online speech that hurts the image of the nation, or online speech that hurts the image of any person, again, minimum 7, maximum 14, still with us, despite proposed changes having been approved. Online speech hurting the image of any person and online speech hurting the image of any nation are rather different. So hurting the image of the nation has been considered to be the same as hurting the image of any high official, particularly the highest officials, and there are scores of people, hundreds of people who've been affected by that. Another critical bit of legislation that has come through, given to us by ourselves very recently in 2016, is the foreign donations, the new law on NGOs effectively, which also many of us call the Transparency International Law, because it was designed specifically, I think, as a slap down to the head of that organization, which says that any criticism of the Constitution or of any constitutional body may result in your having your organization shut down or taken over. And now the latest law that we're being faced with, though we have been promised a few weeks ago that this may be rethought, though I should add that these particular points are not being promised to be rethought at all. Any propaganda against the spirit of liberation, any propaganda against the father of the nation will result in, I forget now whether it's 7 or 10 years imprisonment for the first offense, but I do remember clearly it's a life sentence for the second offense. Needless to say, many of us believe deeply in the spirit of liberation, but this legislation doesn't define for us what that is, nor does it tell us who will be making that definition and who will be deciding what is against and what is for. So in this context, you might think, well, not much is really possible. Who's going to say anything anymore when these are the kinds of laws that you have to operate within? People do carry on saying things, and there are changes still possible. But really, we see a lot of the changes are possible in areas. Changes around rights, changes around issues to do with justice and accountability are possible in areas where there's a commonality with the government's policy aims. So particularly around the issue of women's rights, for example, we see there is a lot of common space. You can see this whole range of changes that have happened in terms of progressive legislation. Some on personal laws in terms of Muslim marriage and divorce laws, some on violence, acid rape, trafficking, domestic violence, reservations on women's participation in politics, both at central level parliament and in local government. Some steps back, I think, indicating a kind of accommodation with religious forces. So, for example, progressive legislation on child marriage, but which is Sharia compliant in some ways, in terms of allowing some exceptions for child marriage in certain cases. The reason I haven't conveniently talked about the progressive changes that we're getting around gender and talked only about women and hijras, because as Tanveer very eloquently told us this morning, of course, LGBT rights are considered completely not acceptable, rejected by the government as something which they claim is not accepted by the people of Bangladesh, though no one has made any effort to find out. And even if it were, there would be an issue that they should be protected as minority rights. But the issue of hijras, there is acceptance by a cabinet division decision saying that hijras are recognized as hijras, and there have been certain actions that have been taken subsequently. In addition to what Parliament and the government have done, there have also been a number of progressive court decisions, and again, many of them have resulted through citizens' action, through public interest litigation combined with campaigning on the ground, preceded by a lot of media activism. On minorities and indigenous peoples, again, you see a slightly different picture. On the issue of religious minorities, we've seen some progressive legislation coming through, again, lobbied for, campaigned for, with pushback, with having to fight and struggle to make it, to implement it. But we have seen changes around the issue of vested property return, very minute change around person laws with Hindu marriage registration, and now a discussion around a draft anti-discrimination act, which only at the minute covers hijras and Dalits, and very interestingly and sadly describes hijras initially as sexually disabled people, to the great irritation of sexual minorities and people with disabilities, obviously. In terms of legislation, the purple bits on this you'll see are to do with actually rights of indigenous peoples in the hills, and are much less easy to deal with. This is all legislation that came on the back of the peace treaty back in 1997, which has been questioned in court through very politicized so-called public interest litigation some years ago, and remains to be decided upon. It's definitely one of those areas where we don't see that citizens groups, at least progressive citizens groups, and pro-Indigenous people, as well as Indigenous people's own organizations, are not seeing eye to eye with the government. Now, what are some of the wins we've made beyond legislation and court cases? I think two of the big ones in recent years on the hard issues, on issues where really there's complete lack of alignment between the government and the ruling party and citizens groups. I think one important one was the Narayanganj 7 murder case, where very swift action by the Supreme Court itself initiated a process of investigation and prosecution, which otherwise would never have happened. The other more recent one is around the Digital Security Act, which I just mentioned to you. There was a huge pushback by journalist groups, by editors, powerful editors with powerful political connections, most of them, which came because journalists had been directly affected by the ICT Act, which exists currently. But I put up this picture just to show that in addition to those powerful political actors, there have also been many, many citizens' organizations talking about this issue. This is just one recent dialogue that was being held with journalists and citizens' groups around the Digital Security Act. And it's been possible, maybe because it's an election year and it's not too many months away, for the law at least to be stopped for the moment. But I want to focus more on, I think, what we've been talking about in this panel is, where is the space constricted? What is it impossible really to talk about? What is it impossible to change? One of them certainly is this big one around Islam as the state religion. This was challenged way back in 1988 when it first came through under Irshad's time through public interest litigation by luminaries such as Begum Sufia Kamal, Professor Anisa Zaman, Justice Habibur Rahman, and others. That public interest litigation sat waiting strategically for such time as we might get a reasonable court that might hear the issues. In 2011, before that case could be heard, you know, just a couple of decades on, the 15th Amendment came into being with not only Islam as a state religion kept, but all of those other provisions that I showed you earlier. That was also challenged. But unfortunately, when these challenges finally came before the court, by that point, these gentlemen that you can see on the screen were already very active on our streets. And their demands were that no Islam in the Constitution, Islam will be the Constitution. By that point, the Hifazat were no longer the enemy, but an ally of our ruling party, and were seen as far more important to appease than citizens' groups, women's organizations, etc., who also had been allies of this government. So the petition brought by Sufia Kamal and others, was rejected by the court immediately without any hearing after all of these decades, on the grounds that she and others had not registered an organization and so were not before court in a proper way, and their case could not be heard. And this, of course, is in this context where in Bangladesh we have public interest litigation by anybody and everybody at the drop of a hat almost every other day without anyone being registered. You know, you're 2 years out of college, you can file a PIL, it's not a problem most of the time. But in this case, it was a problem. So, and on this issue as well, we see that other than the judicial proceedings, there's been very little effort to really change that amendment since. The other issue which we spoke about this morning was around, Tanvir spoke about this morning, was around LGBT rights. This is the Rainbow Rally which he spoke about, which I think was very important as a way forward, which was trying to accommodate and affirm a secular identity and a secular culture cutting across religion, race, caste, and gender, but of course, which, as you know, was threatened by Al-Qaeda, resulted ultimately in the killing of Julhas and Tonoy, and then the blanket and repeated reaffirmations by the government at various levels up to just a couple of months ago, saying homosexuality is against our culture. I'm going to end, given I'm running, I should just mention this in brief. The issues around which there's total impunity, I think we're all very familiar with the discussions around this, extrajudicial killings, disappearances, continual communal acts of communal violence for which there's absolutely no justice, no remedy whatsoever. And a context where no matter what civil society says and does, we don't get change, and we don't get concerted civil society action around the issue of disappearances and extrajudicial killings, because victims also can't come forward in this incredibly hostile environment. I want to just end with two last images for you. This is, of course, Lady Justice, no longer standing where she's standing in this picture, which is right in front of the Supreme Court. She was removed, courtesy of the demands of, again, those same gentlemen, the Hifazat, but she wasn't, fortunately, removed out of the Supreme Court premises at that time. She was just moved to the back in front of another courtroom, which turned out to be much better because most of the courts are in that back section and we all get to see her now. But, of course, Lady Justice was removed, but the Chief Justice, whether he was removed or not, remains to be determined. But the Chief Justice is no longer sitting in the courtroom, which is just behind Lady Justice. And the Chief Justice is an issue about which we can't speak, and I'm not going to speak even in London at this point. And I think that tells you a little bit about where we are. The last image, I think, which is probably the most important of them all, is about how this silence might break. I don't think we will break the silences around rightlessness and around violations, and particularly around the violations committed directly by the state, whether it's through security forces or through proxies of the Chhatra League and the Jubo League and so on, who are in power now and, you know, breaking knees, attacking people, raping women, and all the rest of it. We won't be able to do it, I don't think, as citizens' organizations, rights organizations, and so on. But I think in terms of victims' voices, in terms of the new victims' voices, when we're hearing those, that is going to make some kind of a difference. In the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've heard about over 100 killings in the so-called war on drugs, which has been announced by our government. Every day there have been announcements of killings. Every day there have been announcements of mass arrests. What has stopped it momentarily, not stopped it, but perhaps at least created a certain brief moment of suspension, what did do it for a few days, was the killing of Ikram ul Haq, a councillor from Teknaf, and the playing out in public in this press conference by his wife, Aisha Begum, with his two children on either side, 14 and 11, of the recording of his conversation with his children and his wife, which ended with his being shot live on that recording. And with Aisha Begum's speech, I think that we saw some change coming, because after that, citizens' voices have come through, and the citizens who have actually chosen to be silent, many of our most well-known intellectual, our most well-known cultural activists, those who speak always about why the spirit of liberation will propel us forward, but who too often now are silent about the situation that we face in front of us every day, even they have started to speak. So I think we have to hope that this experience and the voices of victims will finally compel some kind of change, even in the very hostile and difficult environment that we face as citizens' groups. Thank you.
Thank you for those, each of your presentations, but also how beautifully they dovetailed into each other. Now, clearly there is, there are many questions that I'm sure will come up. But it seems to me, and you must correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding from across your three presentations is that when we talk about civil society, we very rarely, I think, in social science, talk about civility as a virtue. And in a sense, the conduct of the state in this, and Bangladesh is by far not alone in this, but we're talking about Bangladesh, that the state has got increasingly uncivil is a proposition from, you know, that's what the evidence is showing, and especially from yours at the end, Sarah, through the legal changes that have been made. And yet, the crisis seems to be that just at the point as the state has got perhaps its most uncivil, its most illiberal, we have a crisis in the capacity of civil society, as you were saying in the start, Joe. that crisis of capacity of mobilization is needed most now, and yet we don't have it. Now, fortunately, I was beginning to get very depressed indeed until you sort of gave us a way out, which at the end, Sarah, with this, the complete precipitation of this crisis through the utter horror of this particular case and the victim's voice somehow cutting through the apathy, the lack of capacity, the silencing, and you think that might be the catalyst that will in fact energize again those very robust and active structures that have existed before, despite the lack of that institutional framework that you've all talked about. Now, I have two specific questions. I mean, that's the way I sort of sum up the connections between the three of you. But I have two specific questions. One, or maybe start with just one. You've all touched the capacity of religion in all of this, which clearly has become, in its political mobilized form, one of the key reasons for this lack of civility and this illiberal tendency across South Asia, but certainly in Bangladesh, from what you're saying. And you very enticingly, Joe, mentioned there's been an increase in philanthropic funding. Now, how much of this is religious funding? What kind of money are we talking about? And we know that the sums are large. Is it because the sources of money, whether it is for the NGO sector, which used to come from multilateral organizations in the past, but now perhaps are outbid by religious organizations from the Middle East, have not only created a complete overturning of the texture of South Asian Islam across the region, but also money like it's never been seen before, but also a political pressure group, much more than a pressure group, a complete rewriting of constitutions to this illiberal extreme that we've seen. So if you could, either any of you, maybe just Joe and Sarah, talk about religion and religious funding in this illiberal, uncivil scenario that you've told us about. Joe, do you want to go first? Or do you want to say something?
I don't know if there is more philanthropy. I think there is more money that could be used philanthropically. The point was that in any other country, in a country like ours, for example, you would have organizations that have got resource mobilizers looking for indigenous sources of money, etc. That money in Bangladesh exists. There are civil people in Bangladesh. There are kind of liberal, right-minded, progressive forces in Bangladesh, and they have money as well. Civil society isn't organized and geared up to tap into that. Yeah? And it's just a kind of interesting, curious question. If you had you go to India and you've got philanthropic money being thrown around at social causes. In Bangladesh, a bit like David was alluding to, the dependence perhaps on donors has stalled or forgone that discussion generally. I link religion to your uncivil states question in the following way. I think that I accept the uncivil state. So why can a state be uncivil? That's the question. And the question then is, there are many good reasons why in Bangladesh right now the state can be very uncivil. First of all, economically, it's performing very well, so citizens are happy. Secondly, it's giving a whole series of benefits to citizens, and therefore more or less they're happy. Third, they can take in Rohingyas by the millions, and Great Britain wouldn't be able to do that, so it's capable. And another big element, and this is where I think religion is, it's managed somehow to co-opt a particular discussion around religion which taps into a lot of citizens' expectations or perspectives or whatever. And so that at one level shoulders up the incivility or uncivility, whatever the question is. So it's doing a lot of good things, and in that it does a lot of compromises. And therefore, it was that question I was trying to raise. At what point do citizens reach a tipping point where those benefits you're giving me, I like them, but not at any cost? And clearly in Bangladesh, we haven't got to that point where not at any cost. There are still more costs that we can make if the benefits keep coming. And so I think the state has still got a bit of space to be even more uncivil.
I think firstly on the funding question, I mean, I think in the past we saw a lot of religion-based funding coming through, Rabita and others, Saudi money and so on coming through madrasas, as well as to a lot of NGOs that were sprouting up and channeling this money. And there was a kind of crackdown on that in terms of anti-terror financing, but even prior to that in terms of this deliberate, this deliberate channeling of funds. But I'm not sure to what extent it is being actually fully monitored. And I think there probably is a concern that in terms of the funds for the Rohingya crisis as well, there's been a new space for some money to come from those kinds of sources. And I think the influence of the OIC, I mean, shouldn't be downplayed, right? The fact that we're seeing ourselves as so central within that particular alliance must surely have some implications, I think, for how we move forward. In terms of the incivility question, I was also going to mention that in the context of the Rohingya crisis, that has now become, I think, because the Bangladesh conversation is now about the Rohingya refugee crisis internationally largely, it means that anything to do with the national political situation and the national human rights situation is of the least concern to the rest of the world. So this issue, for example, around our Chief Justice and what happened to the courts and what has happened to the court in the course of the last 6 months, particularly after the court really put up a massive stand against this attempt to capture the institution and succeeded, but then failed with the way in which the Chief Justice was effectively removed. That didn't get, I think, one sentence of coverage anywhere. How can that be possible? I mean, the judiciary are under attack in other South Asian countries, but it is being looked at, it is being responded to. Other judiciaries are picking up the issue, but our one was completely papered over. And I think that's an example not just of the incivility, but also I think of the very intelligent and strategic way in which the Rohingya crisis has also been deployed to reread, if you like, what is happening internally.
Yeah, I mean, I think this point about the tension between the economic and the civil society, civility, incivility thing that I think everybody's mentioned is I think really important, because I think the state is behaving in uncivil ways, but it's in a selective sense. So on the one hand, you've got this, raft of quite progressive social legislation. You've got all these social safety net, welfare arrangements that have been brought out in the last, 5 years or so, massively expanding the welfare system. But at the same time, you've got this legislation which is restricting associational life, and then you've got the incivility of political violence, increased use of political violence. So I think there's a fragility to the state that is supportable during these good times and this economic growth. And that's why I think, the connections between what we've been talking about around, say, the garment industry and the efforts to preserve and maintain that at all costs, and then these other implications around civil society are really important.
Okay, let's take some questions from the floor. There's a lady right at the back, up top. If I can request you to please keep your questions short and keep them as questions at this stage, not comments. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tamana. I'm a third-year politics and international relations student at the LSE. My question is to Sarah. Thank you for your presentation. It was really interesting. I have a question regarding the idea of the paradox of recognition. You mentioned the Hijras, and the Hijras are actually recognized as a third gender on a lot of voter forms in Bangladesh. But how do we reconcile the fact that the supposed state religion of Islam wouldn't recognize them as people? So is this a paradox in itself?
Can I just take a few questions and then, let's work. Can you raise your hands again, please? And then the gentleman in the front,
Well, hi. There were interesting talks all. Just had two quick questions. One for David. I think in your book you note about the small size of the Bangladeshi state. And I just wondered if that's an issue which you think is important regarding civil society, whether the expansion of social programs has kept a pace with economic growth, and whether the size of the state has sort of kept a pace with economic growth as well, i.e. whether people's expectations are being more met by private enterprise or religious institutions now in relation to the past. And for Sarah, I was interested in the relevance of legislation to do with, or the introduction of a madrasas division in the late 1970s, and the rise of madrasas as social or civil society groups, and how that impacts society now, i.e. you have a generation who is sort of coming into maturity through that system, which is expanding at an incredible rate in terms of the numbers going through madrasas as opposed to secular education.
Thank you. And this question here on my left, you had a question?
Thanks. Chris Chapman, Amnesty International. My question would be whether you would see the Chittagong Hill Tracts as being a special case in terms of the space for civil society. It's bad across Bangladesh. And this is to any of the panelists, really. It's obviously bad across Bangladesh, as we've been seeing, but in the Chittagong Hill Tracts, you have, for example, the government memorandum, which requires people to request special permission, particularly foreigners or foreign diplomats or NGOs, to go to the Chittagong Hill Tracts. But if you want to organize a meeting, even Bangladeshis have to request that permission. And it's explicitly racist. The memorandum talks explicitly about meetings with ethnic minority tribes. Generally, the lack of tolerance for any kind of investigation. The Chittagong Hill Tracts Commission went to the Chittagong Hill Tracts a few years, I think it was 2015, and they were stoned by a mob, and the police and army stood by and did nothing. So, is it possible to say that that's a special case, which is effectively pretty much a closed zone for civil society?
I'll take one more question, and then right in the front here, this lady here, in the white jacket.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about state institutions, because I think both Sarah Sain and David Lewis touched upon how judicial legislation and judicial activism are both happening in areas of commonality. What we saw pre-caretaker government a lot in Bangladesh was that a lot of government institutions were also being held accountable as a result of judicial activism and civil society filing PIL, and this being backed by opposition, actually, in many ways. And therefore, these, whether it's the voter list improvement or the improvements within the Election Commission, that happening by judicial decisions, which are supported by the opposition. Have we seen a major decline in that sort of public interest litigation, which improves state institutions? And if so, how do you see a way out of it with the opposition space being so limited now?
Great. Thank you. David, do you want to start?
Thanks. These are all great questions. I'm just going to take that first one about the state. I mean, I think when I talked about the sort of small state, I think I was talking about a way of thinking about the NGO sector as to some extent being interdependent with the state. And I think quite a lot of people have noticed that one couldn't understand that large NGO sector without also understanding the state. But I think what has changed now is that the reach of the state is extending as that old civil society space that was occupied by NGOs doing things other than providing financial services. As that has shrunk, I think the state is becoming more present locally. So in the Faridpur study that I was talking about, it's noticeable that there are now these much expanded services being provided by the state. You've got the much stronger presence of MPs and their local initiatives, funds. But of course, then you get into a discussion about, are we talking about you know, the ruling political party and the government, or are we talking about the state? And I think we would have to probably have a longer discussion about, you know, whether there is, you know, the project is for the ruling party to occupy more of the of the state and to, you know, become the state in that sense. But there are still massive, you know, I think Bangladesh is really interesting in the sense that you're not having the sort of privatization of the state, in that there are still huge sort of public investments in education, in, you know, public health. I mean, this is a state which is still, you know, retaining a large amount of public services and investment in, you know, in initiatives in, you know, in public space. I think that was all I was going to say on that. I'll leave the other questions to...
Sure. Joe, did you want to comment?
Well, I'll take the easy one then, leave Sarah. It's to build on that, so, and it ties in a bit to the Chittagong Hill Track question. So last year when I was running around in different places in Bangladesh, guess what? No one has any meetings anymore because locally you have to get permission. Now, locally that's not always enforced equally across the country. But you can bet your dollar that if you're an NGO or a civil society organisation who wants to organise a meeting about anything, basketball, if you're not aligned politically in the right way, that meeting's not going to happen. And if it does, you're blacklisted. So is that different from Chittagong? At one level, no. But of course, the Chittagong Hill Track has had, and it's got a geography, it's got the minority discussion we had this morning, so I've got no doubt that... that it occupies a special place. The only thing I would come back now, I think, is in a curious way, I think the number of special places in Bangladesh are increasing. Mm-hmm. And I worry about it.
On the issue about hijras, I mean, I think although that's a, you know, progressive step forward, the problem with it, that decision doesn't recognize the difference of gender identity. It just recognizes hijra specifically. So any transgendered person who doesn't identify as a hijra is not covered or protected by that. And I think Tanvir explained this morning about how even that decision and the way in which it's being implemented is quite problematic. As to whether it's in contradiction with Islam, I have no idea. I'm not much of an expert on that. I think we should ask other people. On the madrasa issue also, as you know, there have been recent decisions recognizing, you know, madrasa education and also saying that it would be equivalent to a master's and there will be an intake from madrasas. And so I think those are pretty problematic. I don't know enough about what happened in the late 70s. On the hill tracks, I think, yeah, it very definitely is considerably worse than anywhere else. Those particular orders may not always be fully implemented. That is one of the benefits of the gap between law and implementation, that sometimes you can maneuver through them. But I think it has a very chilling effect, and it preempts a lot of action that isn't possible. And I think, actually, the more recent developments in the hill tracks, which Meghna could speak about that, I think, much more, about what's been happening beyond the orders and the limitations around speech and so on, is the direct attacks on activists in the hill tracks, the arrests and so on, and the kind of atmosphere that's created. And Adiba, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We've seen a total decline in that kind of public interest case. And actually, if you see my list of things, we're getting, you know, good stuff, good decisions on the kinds of issues that at the end you can't have that much argument with, right? I mean, you shouldn't have discriminatory rules around rape investigations, for example. You shouldn't turn women away from police stations when they come to report rape. I mean, it's honestly hard to argue that that is an anti-state measure that we're requesting from the courts. But on the issues like, you know, whether it's caretaker, whether it's voter lists, those kinds of things, we're not seeing them come. And I think there are two developments. One is that... you know, what's changed inside the court itself in terms of its composition and all of that, how it takes decisions. The fact it doesn't entertain many petitions at the beginning, depending on who's bringing it, who's arguing it. Those, I think there have been significant changes in that area as well.
Okay, let's have another round. Let's start from the top again. Keep your hand slightly raised,
then
I know where and I'll direct
you. All right. This is an interesting presentation because we have, like, different perspective, and I'm still a bit confused about the definition of civil society because it's so diverse. So on that note, my question is like, do you think Bangladeshi civil society, whoever it is, made a mistake by operationalizing the Western concept instead of modifying it, contextualizing it, which would best fit for Bangladesh, parts of Bangladesh context? Because we see like emergence of different challenges. Hafazat is one, the changes in the laws which we impose on ourselves, this is a clear indication that the intermediary role civil society is supposed to play, that failed. And do you think it's a mistake? And can we learn something from that? Yeah. Thank you.
David, white jacket, down.
In fact, Tara there.
If you can just raise your hand a little bit more, the ushers can find you more easily. Yeah, this gentleman here.
Wanted to ask a question about, I think, the politicization of civil society, which Joe spoke about. I mean, obviously, as far as the media is concerned, freedom of expression, as far as the rule of law is concerned, the way in which the courts are operating, things have come to a point where the rule of law is in serious jeopardy in Bangladesh. And I was just wondering whether there are any signs that, you know, civil society might begin to depoliticize around these issues because they are so important to the future of governance in the country. Are there any signs that it's happening? And if not at the moment, do you see any way in which it might happen?
Thank you. Was there, there's a question here? Yeah.
Thank you for your presentations. Is Bangladesh the governance style that has followed in the last sort of 5 to 7 years? It seems to be a much more confident player in how it projects itself in the global space. I've lived out of the country a number of years, but I've worked for a number of years in the country in civil society. So I know a little bit of the flavor for what it was in the 2000s to what it is now in terms of how it's projected in the world. There seems to be a level of confidence, be it the spaceship or the rocket that was sent up in space a couple of months ago, to the, if you believe the numbers, the levels of poverty reduction, GDP growth, all of those things, the number of entrepreneurs in the country. There was a company based in Bangladesh that was valued at $100 million, I think, by international capital markets. There are lots of positives which are being projected globally, and that's a good thing in many ways. But is it symbolic of the governance of the region? Is it trying to follow a Chinese-style one-party state, developmental style of governance, a Malaysian-style state of developmental governance, Singapore even? So is it sort of symptomatic of that?
Thanks. So Joe talked about organizations, NGOs that have been successful because they've been able to work with the rules of the game and with the political economy. Sarah talked about, you know, even though the restrictions are there, those who campaign on areas of commonality with the government have been able to have influence and results. But I'm interested in the other wins that you mentioned, Sarah, like on digital security in Narangganj. What are the characteristics of those successful campaigns that went against the grain but were still able to sort of make some progress and get traction? Thanks.
Thank you. And the final question,
Hi. My question is for Sarah Hussain. I was wondering why in our civil society in Bangladesh there is a lack of there's a lack of self-criticism. Like always there's anything we talk about gets blamed on India or Pakistan or anything else. There's always resistance among many parts of civil society for self-criticism, which we don't see in India. In India, at a drop of a hat, civil society members will criticize against their government or their society, both.
Pakistan gets blamed for a lot.
Yes, both, I think.
Let's have the final set of responses.
Thanks. I'll take the first one. I think it's a really interesting question about this operationalizing the Western concept of civil society as a source of problems. I think the issue I have with that is that there isn't really a single Western concept of civil society. It's argued about and disputed in Western countries and in Western political theory, you know, hugely. So, you know, one can talk loosely about sort of liberal versions of civil society from, you know, de Tocqueville. One can talk about radical notions of civil society, you know, from Gramsci and others. And you know, if one looks at the history of what the support, the foreign support in Bangladesh for civil society has been, it's reflected, I think, those debates. There have been, there have been funders who've clearly been very interested in trying to support that kind of radical notion of civil society. And there have been others, and I think now the norm is that it's the liberal, well, it's a narrow version of the liberal version, because it's actually about the service delivery stuff much more than it is about the accountability of the state and the balancing. But I think it's important to hold on to the fact, though, that these are debates that are being played out here as well. I mean, the government here has, it's legislation wanting to muzzle civil society and the kind of online, critique of government policy. I mean, these are debates all over, all over the world, and I think it's much more complicated than just saying, well, there was this Western version of civil society and it doesn't really fit. I would want to move beyond that. There are different ways of thinking about civil society. And I think when I talk about it, I think it can only really be a sort of loose shorthand term for thinking about how citizens organize and try to hold the state and the markets accountable.
I agree with David on that one. The one question I would throw back is Bangladesh doesn't adopt a model. It's people like us who have got glasses on and minds were rose-tinted and someone else's is less rose-tinted. So I still think it's a question of how we think creatively about what's in front of us and what we can make sense of. And that takes me into the question about the media and the judiciary. Sarah will know much more about the judiciary and the media, but they're symbolically important. They'd be symbolically important in any country. Once that's captured, then you're in real trouble. However, I still go back to what I tried to say earlier. I look at the judiciary and the media, and I can see that split along partisan lines as well. So there's that kind of ongoing tension between partisanship right into every form of civil society, and at the same time we're trying to protect the last bastions of, etc., etc. I don't know what the characteristics of successful civil society activism is, except when you strip everything away, I still think the one thing we need to hold on to is the capacity to increase citizens' subjectivity, and that can take various forms. There's been examples today about online activism, which was successful in the Shabak movement. It was temporary, but it was successful. There are successful cases in NGOs. There are successful cases of judiciary and legal challenges. All of them, I think the core to all of them would have been, at some point, there was some citizen power behind it. And if that's not there, the other bits, hit and miss. Some of them will work, some of them won't work. Will Bangladesh become Singaporean? I don't think so. I think it'll become Bangladeshi. And that's the bit that's interesting. And I suppose your question about the region, the one thing we do know is that whatever Bangladesh, at least in the current political order is, whatever it does, it will always look over its shoulder to India first. Yeah? So it's not going to be an errant, runaway adolescent doing its own thing. It knows its own position geopolitically in the region, and it will take cue from that. But it will build its own form of regime. And I think that will reflect ultimately that level of tolerance, the relationship between state and citizen, and what's the parameters of that contract, and that is an ongoing negotiation.
Just
very quickly. I'm not sure I completely got the question about self-criticism of civil society, but I think that it's true that we don't have civil discourse within civil society very much, and where there's difference, there's smearing, reputational attacks, character assassination, calling people razakars or calling people, you know, whatever it has to be, fundamentalist extremists. That happens at the drop of a hat, and I think that's one of the big challenges in front of us. In terms of the DSA, sorry, I think we don't have much time. In terms of the Digital Security Act, I think that this was kind of a bit of a classic example of actually really effective research and analysis by international human rights groups. Human Rights Watch is sitting here and did a recent excellent report documenting all of the cases under the ICT Act. I think that helped put it on the international agenda. It was one of the questions that came repeatedly during the recent review in Geneva, which the government got. That definitely helped, but I think that wouldn't have been enough at all if there hadn't been powerful political pushback inside the country, as I said, from the editors, because a still powerful group, journalists, came under attack, not just ordinary citizens. But I think probably the key factor was that this is a few months before the election. I'm not going to hold my breath for this not to pass in a problematic fashion after the election. I think we have to wait and see what happens then in a very, very different and challenging scenario.
Okay, I think we're out of time. So thank you very much to all the panelists for a fantastic discussion.